Hello and welcome to the Write Club podcast, where we take you behind the pages and into the fascinating world of writing. This is part two of our chat with best-selling author Carmel Harrington.
Hello. I love the piece you wrote for the April issue of Writing Magazine, talking about genre expectations. And you seem to enjoy exploring different subgenres in your stories. Can you talk us through that a little bit?
You know, it happened by accident, to be honest with you, Mary. I hadn't a clue what I was doing in the beginning. When I wrote my first book, I wrote a book because I had an idea for a story and I just wrote it. And it was very much written from my heart. And it was only after it was published by HarperCollins, my first publisher, and they categorised it as romantic fiction. And I was like, ooh, and then it won an award. It won Romantic eBook of the Year in 2013. So I thought, okay, it is a romance. That's great. Now I know what I've done. But I'd already written my second book, which was a two-book contract, and I had handed it in shortly after I signed the contract. I remember my editor ringing me, and she was like, okay. And the book had done really well. So Beyond Grace's Rainbow was that first book, and it had done really well. And as I said, it won an award. Handed in the second book, and she said, I'm a bit confused. And I was like, why? And she said, you've written a thriller, a very dark thriller. And I was like, have I? I hadn't a clue. I was so, oh my God, when I think about it, it's embarrassing, really. And I literally had written this book, and it was written in the point of view of a serial killer, right, on the loose in a small community in Wexford. And so what she basically did was my editor said to me, look, we can publish that, but you've just got these new readers because they fell in love with your romantic weepy, really, and this very emotional first book. And she said, I'm afraid you'll alienate them. So we discussed the pros and cons and decided that I would get rid of the serial killer's point of view, keep the element there, that dark element in there, but the story would be told through the other protagonist, who was this single mom. And it became very much an emotional exploration of her and what was going on outside of her, which included a murder in the local community. And the book did quite well. And I remember a national newspaper reviewing it and saying that Harrington has seamlessly merged three genres. And I was like, have I? God, I'm very clever. I didn't even know that I'd done that. And when I say, I cannot express how naive and rookie-like I was. And that's not the way to do it. You do need to work out what you're writing before you do it. And like, there are two, you need to know whether you're writing literary fiction or most people are writing genre fiction, which is often referred to as popular or commercial fiction too. And then there are many, many, many subcategories within that genre fiction, and you need to work out which of those you're in.
Yeah, I think that kind of brings us on to the next question here, is just how do you decide what genre that you fit into?
I think the best trick, I've actually been asked that question, you know, if I'm out with doing a talk for other, there's always a writer in the audience, and it's a question I'm often asked, and I know that it's one that's really difficult. I've shared with you very honestly what a fool I was at the beginning, like I hadn't a clue. But you do need to know what genre, because if you're querying agents and querying publishers, you need to be able to say, you need to tell them straight away, my books are written in what, you know, are thrillers, similar to Lisa Jewell. You've got to be able to give examples. And so if you don't know that, you're going to give a very confused message, and your query letter is not going to go very far, because you need to make it easy for an agent or an editor to want to read your sample chapters. And the best way to work that out is go to your favorite bookshop, because bookshops are, they're in the business of making life easy for readers to find their favorite book. And so they will categorize books in pretty much the main subgenres that you find. So when you go into a bookshop, just think about it. Okay, you've got your bestsellers at the front of the shop. We all want to be there. But other than that, bestsellers charts, you go to the thriller section if you want a thriller. You go to the historical fiction, romance section, science fiction, horror, fantasy, action and adventure, all of these different subgenres, which are the main subgenres, general fiction, literary fiction. That's what you need to do. So I would say go to a bookshop and basically try to imagine the book you've written, where would it sit? And if you can't work that out, try to work out then which authors are you similar to, and be honest. Like, there's no point thinking, oh, I'm a Sally Rooney if you're a Marion Keyes. Do you know what I mean? Really work out who your writing is most like. And if you need to get advice on that, do, you know, and work it out. And then you can kind of try and hone in, okay, well, where do their books sit? Whose books are you most similar to in that sense? And that's a way of working it out and giving you at least a strong chance moving forward of getting it right. And you can change as you go along too. You don't have to stay there, but it's good to have a lane at the beginning.
Yeah, definitely. That's really interesting, actually. And I think as well, it's really important, like a second opinion in some of these situations, because what you think, how you've written might be like it, somebody else might read that and think, oh, that's not quite how I read it. So yeah, no, that's really interesting. And do you think there are any like common themes throughout all of your 13 books?
Yeah, and you're so right, by the way, just to finish on what you just said there. Like, we all think we're Booker Prize winners, but we're not, right? And that's okay. We can't all be Booker Prize winners. We can't all write a literary piece of a masterpiece that's going to transcend cultures and generations. There has to be, some of us have to write the popular fiction that hopefully makes the bestsellers charts, but that is read over and over and over again and enjoyed it in like an escapist read. And that's okay too. So it's good to kind of know which you are and not to kind of put yourself in the wrong place. But I'm sorry, I just wanted to kind of finish that back. So what will you do? Sorry, I know I've kind of lost. What did you ask me that time now? Because I went, that's my fault. I went off on a tangent. You
No,
asked
that's
me.
fine. Are there any common themes throughout your 13 books?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, there are actually. I would say that every single one of my books, right from the beginning, have had mysteries at the heart of them, and they are mysteries within a family structure. I write family dramas, really, whether those dramas have been historical fiction, as I've written, have been contemporary fiction, have been dual timelines, or emotion or thrillers, as I'm writing now. They've all been centered around kind of the dramas that a family face. And I think that's really the link between them all. And then, as well as that, I do write characters are very important to all my stories. And I personally like to read authentic characters who are real and relatable. And that's what I try to do. And it's a good day at the office for me when a reader gets in touch and says, I read your book and the character of X, Y, or Z. I really related to, and that happened to me, or I know someone that happened to, and that's really great. And I do try to make my characters, I work hard to make them very realistic and that their actions are believable and feel true and authentic.
Sorry, I just wondered, how do you make your characters feel so real? Are you listening into conversations? Are you basing them on real people?
They become real to me, and that's the trick. Only when a character becomes like somebody in my family. This is again, I'm showing you the real crazy Carmel Harrington here now. But sometimes I will actually wake up and I'll go, oh my God, I wonder what's happening with Elsie. And for a minute, I've forgotten that Elsie is a character in my book and I'm worried for her. And I'm going, oh my goodness. And then I go, okay, Carmel, relax. Elsie is your imagination out. I think we all have to be a little bit crazy to be a writer. But all the best people are crazy. I also believe that too. Alice in Wonderland taught us that, the Mad Hatter. So yes, we're all a little bit crazy. But I think that. What I do to try and make them real is I have a set of questions that I ask my characters right at the beginning, and then I ask them several times into the writing process. I ask them again, and the questions I have are not like the usual, like what's your age, whatever like that. I like to ask them some questions to get to their nitty-gritty. For example, one of the questions I ask is, who do you call to bring the shovel? And what I mean by that is, we all have somebody that if we've done something terrible, we know that we can call them in the middle of the night and say, oh my God, I've murdered someone. And they say, okay, I'm on my way with the shovel. Like, you know what I mean? And they are, so we all have those ride or die friends. And I like to know who my characters are. And it's really important for me to know that. And sometimes if a character says to me, I don't have anyone, that's important because then you're going, okay, they're alone. So you kind of get this understanding as to who's important to someone. And actually the character I'm writing in next year's book at the minute, she hasn't got a ride or die, but that's part of, so that was quite interesting. Okay, well, this is going to be part of her story because as well as telling the story I want to tell, I'd like her to have a ride or die before the end of the book. So it kind of can give you a little subplot as well. So I ask questions like that. There's another question I ask, which is a little bit dark, but it's very illuminating. And I ask the question, who would you put on the bus? So these questions mean nothing to anyone else. They're just for me. So what that is, I remember, right, my husband was having a particularly bad day in the office. years ago, and he came home, he was frustrated anyhow, and I said, right, I said, here's what we're going to do. I said, we're going to put all of those people into a bus, and we're going to take that bus, and we're going to literally drive that bus to the edge of the cliff, then we're getting out, and we're going to stand behind the bush, and we're going to push the bus over the cliff. And he's like, that's so dark. And I said, I know, but isn't it great? You're going to feel so much better. So anyhow, this is, he's like, okay, this is life with a writer. So he said, okay. So we did that. So it became a bit of a joke with us. If we're having a bad day or someone has done something. So we were like, are they on the bus? Yeah, they're on the bus. So I asked my characters, who's on the bus? And by doing that, immediately I get an insight into a character as to who is causing them harm, who is causing them trouble. And sometimes, like, I remember when I wrote a book a few years ago, and it was a character called Greta Gale in My Pear-Shaped Life. And when I asked her that question, she said, I'm on the bus. And I was like, oh my God, I was so sad for her. And I thought, she really, really hates herself. She's so filled with this, she really poor body image. It's a story about body image, really. And I thought, my goodness, that's really sad, isn't it? So that helped me with her character then. So those are the questions. So I have a list of 10 questions that really make sense only for me, but I ask them every time.
I love that. That's brilliant. You gave us a little tease there, but can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on next? Or currently?
Yes. I can't tell you the title yet because we haven't released it. But we are releasing it very soon. So actually, maybe when this comes out, but it's, and we're sharing the prologue to it at the end of The Stolen Child when it's published. So people will be able to get a sneak peek. But the story is a dual timeline, and it's a thriller again. And it starts in 1995. And two little girls aged 3 and 4, two sisters, are found on a train platform. And they're waiting for their mother, and their mother never comes to claim them. And the only thing that they know about themselves is their first name. They don't know their surname, nor do they know where they're from. They know that they live very remotely with woods and sea near them, and that's it. And nobody comes to claim them. No family members comes to claim them. And they eventually, they're abandoned, essentially. But they're very well dressed and look well taken care of. And there is obviously love with their mother. So this huge mystery surrounds them. Then in the present day, a journalist decides to write a story about those abandoned girls. And this will bring her to a commune and cult in Woodstock in Vermont in America, and back to Connemara in Ireland. So there's kind of decades of all sorts of shenanigans going on with that. So that's what I'm writing at the minute. That's next year's book.
Very intriguing, yeah.
It's fun. I've always wanted to write about a commune and cult. I've just been fascinated by them, and I kind of wanted to kind of do my spin on that. So yeah, that's, it's not a religious cult, I will say that, but it's definitely a commune. It was great fun because I'm being brought back to America in the 1960s, where it was like kind of an era of looking for peace, not war, with the Vietnam War going on, and rock and roll and music had really changed the lives of these young children and young teenagers and young adults, and they wanted to have a different way moving forward. So it was quite a lot of people moved and kind of checked out and moved to communes in America. So it's quite interesting to look at that era. It's been really fascinating, actually, my research.
Yeah, but I'm really looking forward to reading that. It sounds right up my street.
Thank you.
What sort of advice do you have for any aspiring writers? Obviously, a lot of the people that are going to be listening to this podcast are in that category. What kind of advice would you give them?
I would say, first and foremost, write the book. And I think that it's very easy to get lost in all the other stuff that you have to do as an author. And we know that writing the book is only one piece of the puzzle. After that, there's so much more that has to happen. But if you don't write the book, none of the other stuff is going to happen. And I think sometimes writers get lost in, oh, well, I need to set up a social media platform. I have to have my author platform. No, you don't. You just need to get the book written, and then you can do all of that afterwards. So I think that just write the best book you can possibly can. And the other thing I would say is that when you do submit it, when you start that process of submitting it, make sure it's in the best possible condition before you send it off. And I think a lot of writers are just so excited and anxious to send it in. But I can tell you, I guarantee you, that no matter what you've written, when you think that it's in the best possible condition, it's not. So I would take time and I would literally wash cars to get the money together to pay for a third party edit for it, you know, structural edit, to make sure there are no holes in it. And like, again, I think a lot of writers, they say, oh, my best friend is a teacher and she's, that's different. Like, it's great to have someone like that who's going to correct your grammar or whatever. That's great. But that's really not the edit you need. I think you need to make sure that there are no plot holes in it and that structurally it's sound, and that you've opened the book in the right place and all that kind of stuff. So I would say spend time, spend money. Time is your biggest resource here. And make sure that when you send it off, that you can sit back and you can say, if they say no, there was nothing more I could do, rather than you send it off and they come back and they say, well, you know, that it was really sluggish in the first three chapters, and, you know, it wasn't, you know, and then you're regretting it. So you only have one chance, so make sure you don't mess it up. That's what I would say to people. So take your time, take a deep breath. You can do it. Have belief. You can definitely do it. I'm proof of that. At any age, you can do it. But don't be in such a rush that you don't do it well.
Amazing. That's brilliant advice. So we always end by asking for a book recommendation. What have you got for us?
She's one of my go-to authors. Whatever she writes, I'm going to buy straight away. I always pre-order her books, and that's Leanne Moriarty. And she is one of those genre-defying authors that she actually can write books that fall into romance, mystery, thriller, general fiction, and she's just genre defying, and readers don't care, they're going to just buy those books because she writes so well and her characters are so excellent. And her latest book is called Here One Moment, and I absolutely adored it. And it's such an original premise. It's a group of strangers on a flight, and a woman begins walking through the cabin and making a prediction about how each passenger and crew member is going to die and at what age they're going to die. So it's terrifying for them all. Some are cross, some are scared. There's like, it causes major problems on the flight. But as the tagline said, I wrote it down because the tagline is so good, no one believes a prediction until it comes true. And so after the flight, the predictions begin to come true, and people who have been told that they're going to die, certainly it starts to happen. And so these strangers on the flight have to get together to try and find out who the psychic, clairvoyant or charlatan, nobody really kind of knows who or what she is, but they've got to find out who she is. And some of them are kind of racing against the clock because they've been told that they're going to die at a certain time, which is coming up soon. So it's really original and interesting. And really, at the heart of it, it's Leanne Moriarty peeling back the layers of characters. So while you've got this interesting premise, it's all about looking at the lives of all these individuals. And if you like Nine Perfect Strangers, or, you know, which she wrote, which was, I think, of a very similar vein, you'll enjoy it.
That sounds amazing. Sounds up my street.
Very different. I really loved it, you know, I thought it was great.
Well, thank you so much, Carmel. It's been a pleasure to speak to you. Your latest novel, The Stolen Child, is out on Friday the 27th of February. I think that's correct. And you've very kindly said that you will read the first page for us, which would be a real treat.
Yeah, well, what I thought I'd actually do is I'm actually going to read kind of the last page of the first chapter, if that makes sense, because I think that's going to give you, it kind of sets up the whole story. So it's kind of two half pages, if you like, but I'm going to do that. So here we go. And this is the first time I've done a reading from this book. So it's kind of a moment for me. It's always exciting to share. So just to set the scene, this is 1983 on a cruise ship around the Mediterranean, and the Murphy family are sharing this cabin. The dad, Jason, has gone out for a drink, and the mum is getting the kids, 2.5-year-old Robert and 6-month-old Lily, ready for bed, and then she's going to bed herself. The dad has gone out for a drink, so that's where we've started. Back in their cabin, once Lily had drunk her bottle and was drifting off to sleep in her crib, Kimberly turned her attention to Robert, who sat cross-legged on the floor watching TV. Cartoon Tom chased Jerry menacingly around the garden, and a shiver ran down Kimberly's back as she picked up Robert's empty nighttime bottle of milk from the floor beside him. "I drank it all, Mama," her little boy said proudly. "You are such a good boy. Come here to me," Kimberly said, holding her hand out to him. "I sleepy, Mama," Robert replied, wiping his eyes with his hands. He clasped his beloved Peter Rabbit soft toy in his right hand. Kimberly picked him up and gently placed him in his sofa bed. Then climbing in beside him, she read him his favourite bedtime story, Goodnight Moon. Even before Kimberly was halfway through, the quiet poetry had lulled Robert asleep in her arms. She lay beside him until her eyes became heavy too, the power of her sleeping tablet taking effect. Kimberly almost stayed there, her little boy wrapped up in her arms, safe, the two of them together. The temptation to hold on to him and never let go was overwhelming. But then Lily stirred in her cot and the sound brought Kimberly back from the brink of sleep. She kissed Robert one last time, breathing in his scent, then carefully placing Peter Rabbit under the crook of his arm. "I love you more than the moon," Kimberly whispered. Slowly she made her way back to her double bed, her legs heavy and uncooperative, falling onto the mattress with one last, "Good night, moon. Good night, Lily. Good night, Robert." Her eyes closed and all was dark. Lily's cries woke Kimberly. She sat up groggily, looking around the small cabin in surprise. Her head thumped as if she'd been partying late into the night, and she could smell stale beer. It took her a moment to remember that they were on a cruise ship, not at home in Dublin. "What time is it?" Jason mumbled from beneath the bedclothes. Kimberly looked down at her watch and answered, 7. She pulled Lily from her cot and held her close, instantly soothing her cries. The sound of a vehicle rumbling nearby drifted up to the cabin from outside. "We must have docked in Barcelona," Jason said, stretching his arms above his head. "God, I feel rough. I drank way too much last night." He made his way towards Robert's sofa bed. "Wake up, sleepyhead. Come on, buddy. Let's go out to the balcony and take a look at Barcelona." Jason pulled back the white duvet to reveal an empty bed. "He must be in the bathroom," Jason said. He opened the ensuite door, his expectant smile turning to a frown. "Robert's not in here either." Jason's voice rose as he called out, "Buddy, where are you hiding?" With Lily in her arms, Kimberly joined Jason and they both searched for their son in the small cabin. Kimberly moved slowly, her legs immobilized with terror. The cabin was only 140 square feet, so the search was over as quickly as it began. "He's not here. He's gone," Jason said, his face white, sweat glistening on his forehead. He ran to the cabin door and opened it, running out into the hallway and calling out their son's name desperately. Kimberly clutched her chest, dread twisting her gut and heart. Then she began to scream.
Oh, wow. It gave me shivers. It's every parent's nightmare, isn't it?
I mean, that's it. And that's the tagline, every parent's nightmare, but nobody's waking up from this. I feel a bit emotional reading that to you guys. It's like reading it. I hope you enjoyed it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah. I can't wait to read it. It's going to be great.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm really excited about this one. I hope that readers love it as much as I loved writing it. Genuinely, it was just a joy from start to finish. It really was. Even the difficult moments were really great, if that makes sense. You know, it was a nice one.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Write Club podcast. Carmel Harrington's latest novel, The Stolen Child, is out now.